This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Happy Memorial Day weekend. We made it. Got some great beach reads to tell you about. We begin with Stephanie Weiler. She's a juvenile court judge in Ohio with enough real-life experience to draw on for a lifetime of legal thrillers. And she begins with Certain Truths.
Basically what I've been doing for a living for the past 40 plus years. After graduating from law school, I did about 2 years as an assistant prosecuting attorney, spent a little more than a decade after that in the private practice of law, practicing criminal defense work, family law, the general private practice of law. And for the past 30 years, I've been on the bench in the juvenile court in our county. So I've had daily inspirations and daily seedlings of plot lines that would make a compelling legal thriller, which is what my book genre is. The way the book ends leaves room for a sequel for readers who can't get enough of my hero, Jackson Berman.
Now, is he based on, are these composite characters?
They are. Composite characters. I should probably also add that I'm married to probably the best criminal defense attorney in the greater Cincinnati area. So he's a great source of inspiration for stories and vignettes that would be appropriate for this type of book. The reader becomes acquainted with Jackson Berman, who is a criminal defense attorney in Cincinnati, whose professional career is on the rise. He's earning quite the reputation as being a staunch defender of those who are rightly and wrongly accused. However, while his professional career is on the rise, his personal life is going in the opposite direction. He finds himself separated from his wife, and in the throes of that conflict, he's trying to maintain a healthy relationship with his preteen daughter. In the midst of all of this juggling of the highs of his professional life and the lows of his personal life, he finds himself accused of a horrific crime that could send him to prison for the rest of his life. So the issue is who defends the defender.
Ooh, okay. You leave us hanging there.
Well, this book resolves the issues of certain truths, which is the title. Certain, if you think about the word certain in and of itself, it works on two levels. Certain can mean absolute, without question. It is with certainty. But certain can also be defined as some, not all. So as a criminal defense attorney, the reader kind of understands, hopefully, the dilemma that is facing a criminal defense attorney every day of their professional life, dealing with absolute truths, and dealing with certain truths, some truths that need to be ignored or not brought into evidence. And in this situation, while he is very adept at doing that as a criminal defense attorney, he needs to find the absolute truth behind the allegations that could ruin him for the rest of his life.
Wow. So I'm assuming people know you wrote this book.
They do.
Yeah. And I'm thinking you probably go out. Do you talk to other law students? I mean, when it comes to promoting, quote unquote, your book, do you have access to an audience?
Well, it's funny that you say that. As we speak, within the next 30 days, I will be speaking at my first book club that invited me once I posted on my Facebook author page. So that'll be my first experience with the book club. And I'm booked into 3 local bookstores within the next 6 weeks for an evening with the author and a book signing. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it.
That's the way to do it. I'm assuming you're pretty well known in your community.
They know the name, yes.
Yeah, so that gets you a little leg up on people who are not so well known in their communities, because I'm always saying to people, they're like, oh, I have to go on a book tour. I'm like, no, do an author talk in your town. You know, start where you are, and then you can go from there. So why did you choose Page Publishing?
I chose Page Publishing because I have a friend who self-published a book about 3 years ago, and through her, I got invited into a private Facebook page called Writers Helping Writers. And it was through reading it and looking at exchanges that Page Publishing was touted as being a great publisher. And as the more I learned about it, once I got ready to submit my manuscript, I submitted it to Page Publishing. And that was the only one I had to submit it to. I got picked up by them. So I didn't get any rejection letters.
Oh, that's the best part, Stephanie. We hate rejection letters. Well, thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you when you write your next book. Nolan Simmons worked for a healthcare company that made hospital equipment before he was unceremoniously dismissed. But writing helped him deal with the fallout. And as a result, he wrote Malibu Glen, In Life and Business, You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up.
After 40 years essentially in the same business, my departure wasn't exactly pleasant. And so I was kind of in a funk, and I was just sitting at my regular breakfast place. And I said, you know, maybe I could just write some stuff down as therapy, as some way to get past the disappointment, the anger, whatever. And so I just started writing kind of like an outline. And once I hit 25 pages of this outline, I said, wait a minute, this is a lot of material. So went out and bought a laptop computer and started sitting at the breakfast club. And I gave myself a goal of a page a day. And that's what I did. I wanted it to be about a life in business, about my fictitious character, Malibu Glen. So literally, I started all the way back in high school. And my first job selling to people and just kind of worked my way through college, how I picked my major, how I got involved in business, and, you know, all the hijinks throughout the years. And I tried to make the book funny, but also kind of real life for this fictitious guy, just basically saying, okay, this is what's happening to me now, and this is what happened then, this is how I got here. I wanted it to be cathartic as well as maybe something people would get something out of. So the book is broken into two parts. The first part is how I got here. And then the second part, broken up, by the way, by my favorite old-fashioned recipe. The second part is basically the business philosophy that I use to manage very successful, record-breaking sales teams. You know, so it's difficult to categorize the book. It's not really a business book. It's not an autobiography. Kind of joke in the very beginning that everything in the book is true except where it's not. You know, the characters are real except where they're not. Kind of joking a little bit to whet the people's appetite that is this real? Did this really happen to this guy, or is this all just, you know, fictitious?
Right. Well, you know, the rest of the title is In Life and in Business, You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. I'm curious as to, give me an example of the kind of stuff you just can't make up.
So let's just say when I was finishing up my degree, a friend of mine and I were standing in the chemistry lab, and his father at the time was a PhD chemist teaching at one of the universities. And we see this bottle of Armorall on the shelf. And he picks it up and he goes, what would they need Armorall for in a chemistry lab? And he just mindlessly squeezes the bottle top a couple of times. And out comes this mist of Armorall. And neither one of us even thought about the consequences of that mist settling on the vinyl floor. Well, he puts the bottle back up and the section head comes over in a hurry to get something in the section we were in, and she hits the section of floor. And when I tell you her feet went in front of her and she flew into the cabinets, I am not exaggerating.
Oh.
And of course, who gets the blame? Me. I was more outgoing. Eddie was very reserved and very quiet. And Marcel, who the lady's name who was in charge of chemistry, she gets up, kind of brushes herself off, and comes right at me. What did you do? And Eddie's like, well, I could leave now and you know, be safe. But to his credit, he said, hey, I think I might have did that. But, you know, throughout my entire time in that department, anything that went wrong, even if I wasn't there, was my fault. You can't make that stuff up.
No, you can't, Nolan, and I know exactly where you're coming from. Thank you. Robin Roberts lives on a mountaintop in Oregon, named for a Phillies pitcher from the 40s. He was a tech writer for a NASA affiliate that made the original motors for the space shuttle, and now he's writing fun stuff like Sorensen's Gift.
Oh, I've been writing since probably high school, but basically I'm a reader. I was an early reader, an avid reader. I read everything, and you can't be a reader without being a writer, I think.
I agree.
Most of my books come from dreams. I'm not one of those people who forgets their dreams. When I wake up in the morning, I remember them. And the dream itself is somewhat simplistic. It was about the story man, a man who came to the park and told stories to the children. And he was very, very enchanting and stuff. And when I started writing that, I ended up with this book. Basically what happens, the protagonists are three young people. Ryan, who's 13, his sister Stevie is 8, and their friend Simmy is 13, like him. They learn about the story man. They go to the park and listen to him, and then he comes every couple of days, several times a week. But he doesn't show up for a week. So they go to the house to find out why. And while they're investigating the house, Stevie falls into a chest. When Ryan goes to rescue her, she's gone. And that's how the story starts. And this chest carries them into an America that, instead of having a president and independence and all that, has a king and a bunch of independents. It has these three political parties in it, and the three children get very, very involved in the three different aspects of their politics. They want to come back, but they have to figure out how, and they don't know how. And in the process of discovery, well, like it says on the back cover, it's, what is that?
They find themselves embroiled in the politics of an America they never knew existed. Racing against impending war, they find themselves battling king and clergy in a desperate attempt to rescue Stevie and return to their own world. But before they can find Stevie, they must find each other and themselves.
Good writing. Who wrote that?
I don't know who wrote that, but boy, was that fun to read.
Oh, I did.
I think I want to read the whole book now.
Cool.
Now, are you going to leave us hanging on this book and lead us into another book?
I've written four of them so far. It's a series. Each one is complete within itself. They make it back and all of that. And the next book, they have a separate adventure also involving the chest. The chest is Sorensen's gift. Professor Sorensen gives that to them. You'll find out more about that. But that is Sorensen's gift.
And that's why the name of the book is Sorensen's Gift.
Yes, ma'am.
So, do you have any libraries near you or bookstores near you?
There is a library downtown, and I'm going to give them a couple of copies.
Well, why don't you do an author talk?
Do we have a place downtown called Painted Sky? It's the Center for the Arts, and they periodically invite local painters and writers to come and sit and do that, and I'm on their list. I've already done a signing downtown. There's an organization called Oregon Rain, RAIN, and it's a entrepreneurial support organization, and I've been contacted by the local representative. And one of the things they do is they do a 6-week how to market with the internet and social media and stuff. And I'm going to take all of those. They're free. And Zach, who's a guy from Rain, he's going to go down to high school and see about maybe getting my book on the required reading list.
That sounds great, Robin. You're a local author. You're like a local celebrity.
I told him to offer that if the kids read it, that I will come and sit down and do a question and answer period afterwards. High school kids, you read great stuff, but you never get to even meet the author. So I just thought they might appreciate that.
Well, I hope our authors are taking notes because you're doing all the right stuff, Robin. Thank you. John Reisner is an ER nurse who worked in his dad's raisin vineyards from the time he was about 12, where he learned some valuable lessons and Spanish while he was at it. The experience served him well and inspired his book, Hola Bala, Letters.
I grew up on my grandfather's ranch, and I worked out in the field with the workers. And so my grandpa always impressed upon me how important it was to learn their culture, learn their language, and understand, because they do work that nobody else will do. I mean, they bust their butts out there. So he really instilled upon me a respect for them. And so I learned some Spanish from them. And then when I got into nursing, there it was again. It was just a needed language. And so I wanted to try to bring the two languages together. Because especially out here in California, it really is a major language for us.
So what's the significance of Hola Bala letters?
So as an ER nurse, there was a gentleman I worked with. His name was Bala, and he was from Nigeria. And he had this super strong accent, and he was always trying to talk Spanish. Nobody could understand him. And so one night I just told him, just say hola, hola bala. And I told him, that sounds perfect. That sounds like a kid's book. I'll make a kid's book out of that. And he laughed at me, and it became a kid's book. It's a children's bilingual beginning reader's book. So this one is about two characters, Bala and Anna. And she speaks English, he speaks Spanish, and they learn language together. So the first one is letters. So it's basically going through the alphabet, learning about some animals and different things through the alphabet. They're relating to both the cultures and showing that they can have a good friendship and, you know, that they can build off each other. They can learn from each other. And I think that's a key. That's a basis.
They're bonding over the...
Absolutely. Over the language.
Do they use examples from their cultures to learn about the letters?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, you have letter A and it's an airplane. And then it'll be in English and it'll be in Spanish so that you can learn both translations. Second one that is going through publishing right now is about the human body.
And then you have a series of books?
Correct. Six total. The second one is going through publishing right now. It's actually getting the artwork finished. That one's the human body. But I'm trying to get into schools. I'm trying to just get the word out there. I bought 100 books, or no, 50 books, sorry. And I hand them out to little kids that are bored or scared, you know, when I'm at work in the ER, and I give them to them. And I've had great positive responses so far.
Oh, that's nice. Are you able to do local libraries? You can read to kids during the summer or, you know, anything like that in your neighborhood?
So they're just starting to get back to that because of the COVID. They had cut all those out. So they're just starting to get back to that.
And so you'll be able to kind of get into something like that?
Yeah, that is the plan. If you're bilingual, it puts you so much further ahead out here. And you know, you're talking here, you're talking the whole West Coast plus Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, that whole area. The Southwest and the West Coast.
Same for the Northeast, John. You know, it serves you well here in New York City, Connecticut, New Jersey. Same deal. Thank you so much. Julidor Cornille was raised in the Bahamas, where he has imagined a court case 30 years in the future that would return every human to their rightful place in his book, Indigenous, the first of a trilogy.
Being multicultural, I guess. My parents came from Haiti. I was born in the Bahamas. So that immigration thing kind of struck a chord. But I wanted to do something global and not domestic. So the book, it's basically a global book. So I'm pretty good at commerce and economics and history and culture and geography. So I just wanted to find a fair playing ground. And I just tried to write the book as neutral as I possibly could and not favor any particular side or race or whatever you want to describe it. Native Americans take the United States Constitution to court 30 years in the future, and they were able to win the court case, and the United States, which includes Alaska in the north to Argentina in the south, and all the Caribbean, is awarded back to Native Americans or Native Indigenous First World people. And everybody else has to leave. If you're not 50.01% Native American, you can stay. But if you're not, you have to leave. And that includes everyone.
Where do they go?
They go back to their country of DNA dominance, meaning that once you take a DNA, wherever your DNA percentage is highest, that's the country you go back to. So it makes it fair for everyone to go back to, a more welcoming place.
What's their argument?
I left it vague in the first book to create this curiosity for the second one. You will be hanging, and that's why you'd want to get the second one. Had they won the court case, they had to have been prepared to take over the new world on day zero. Now, mind you, you're interested in the court case, but the other archetype in this book is the actual judge who is presiding over this court case. That's the one who really is the main character, because this judge is a computer, whereby this judge is just absolutely, unfortunately fair. That's the hard part, because he came about because of the corruption that you would have found from leaders from as far back as you could remember to today, up to 30 years in the future. So countries form this computer with algorithms to be but one thing, fair. And the judge can't not be fair because of the algorithm that is put in. The judge has 50% of global assets and 50% of global artillery. And if you could imagine between today and 30 years in the past, everything was recorded. And from today to 30 years into the future, everything is even much more recorded. So therefore, to pass judgment on you for something that you would have done, all the evidence is there to prove and justify what you would have done, because every step you take would have been recorded. And that's the reason why the court case, the end result, happens quickly, so that it creates a big hole in the ground to say, well, how did this happen? And then when I start to unravel the historical events to support both attorneys' side, it's mind-boggling. So just imagine the computer's ability 30 years from now. It's not a utopia, but something similar.
All right, Jewel Adorb, interesting stuff. Thank you. How far off the grid can you get? How about outer space? A.F. Carcieri did a lot of writing for his government job, but was inspired to get creative when he least expected it. He brings real life and fantasy together in his book of short stories entitled Starbright.
This particular thing kind of came about through a story that a coworker was reading from her local newspaper in Fall River, Massachusetts, about some reclusive man who was found living in his own particular little bunker in Nantucket, Iowa, Boy Scout camp, which made me really think, wow, how far off the grid can you get to that, okay? So a couple of years later, I was giving a Toastmasters speech, and I did it about the planet Venus. Then I put the two of them together, like, how far off the grid can you get living on a planet Venus in your own little villa with no one knowing you're there? Actually, that's what kind of drove me into really thinking about the planet Venus a lot. And I started and I wrote the first story about that particular idea. It's called Except for the Morning Star. And that is like the last story in the 16 stories that make up my recent published book, Starbright. You might consider it the Martian Chronicles. It might bring that to mind. But this kind of spans from the beginning of the human race until the end. Okay, and it has to do with the planet Venus and how people thought of it so deeply and more profoundly in days gone by as opposed to today. At one time, the morning star, the evening star, what we call planet Venus, is something we take for granted and no one really thinks much about it. Whereas in the past, it was thought of much more deeply and it had greater effect on people's lives. Okay, and it influences them to do things. And also, since they believed that it was a god or a goddess, many of them worshipped and prayed for it. Usually it was things like bring me fair weather so that the crops will grow and things of that nature. But this is other things is like make me great and make me powerful and help me to be like you and that kind of thing.
I mean, you talk about the characters, you know, an ambitious young woman of the summer civilization and her extraordinary companion, a fatalistic Israelite king, leading an army off to war. This is just one of the stories. And then a spoiled, rotten countess of the French Bourbon dynasty who harbors delusions of godhood. I mean, these are all characters that we're going to find in your book.
Yes. And now what that kind of it comes down to is it is a genre jumping book. Okay. It's primarily a work of historical fiction, but it's also about mythology, superstition, and all kinds of things. It goes through some periods where there's some very unpleasant stories, things about war and other things like that. But also some, you know, I do kind of have it sometimes a lighthearted way of writing. So one of the guys, Adelphone's quest for love, something of a misfit, and he's not really very good at anything. So he gets in trouble a lot to make himself, to get himself the bad boy image, which modern day, say, a member of the male gender does something to attract attention, no matter the idiocy involved. As a rather awkward scene in The Emperor's Planet where an individual who's found himself disrobed and he's running away from the marquee who runs the place. She falls down and he accidentally steps on her face. She's a real tyrant. Things of that nature, which I think are a little bit amusing. One thing, I think more than anything else, I enjoy it. It's kind of fun. And I think that's as far as I can give some advice to anyone. That would be it. You should really like what you're writing.
Yeah, it sure helps. I mean, I don't even know how you could, I don't know how you could write a creative story, an interesting story, an intriguing story, unless you were enjoying it along the way. I mean, that's why we're always telling writers, look at your own life. Look at your own experience. I mean, look at you. You had a coworker, right? Shared a story with you that she read in her local newspaper. And you ran with it. You never know where that inspiration is going to come from. So that's good advice. Very good advice. And we're at the end of the road here. I got to get out of here. I got to get to the beach. I got some reading to do. Listen, thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. If you missed anything or you just want to keep listening to our shows over and over again, all you have to do is go to 710WOR.com and download the podcast. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Same time, same place. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini.